presenting in contexts where people are actually going to be doing frontline caregiving. So it's a real pleasure to be here. And I was thinking about it, it's the first time that I remember speaking in a specifically nursing setting. And as I was sort of looking to see if there was some way I could adapt it to make it more relevant, it came as a real shock to me, although not as a shock, it's sort of obvious, that I didn't need to adapt anything. Because I've been presenting this to doctors who really don't really care as much as nurses care about these issues, because they don't have to. They actually don't have anywhere near as much contact with the impossible patients that you have. And when I was looking at our fieldwork notes, you'll see, actually, and I didn't add any more nurses or even, you know, edit it to include more. And actually, the person who did the actual editing is here, Zoe, so she can attest to this. And the fact of the matter is, the people that I'm going to be talking about primarily deal with nurses. The biggest conflicts are with nurses, and the biggest friendships and sort of life-changing types of relationships are with nurses. So you'll see that, and I didn't, and you'll see it in the fieldwork notes. What I'm going to do is present material. Put this here. From, I think I can do it like this. Yeah, present material from a book that I just finished. Is the sound okay? It sounds a little bit strange, doesn't it? Okay, a little further away. Okay, I just have to be careful. I had iatrogenic throat surgery, and it's taking too long to recover, so I get it. But that's fine, right? I don't need to scream. I can hear it. Okay, thank you. You should spit at me so I didn't think that. Anyhow, I'll just finish this book. It's based on much smaller field among social network of panelists, heroin injectors, and crack smokers in San Francisco. And this is our benefit picture. And as you probably can guess, it's a lie. Actually, people on this team hate each other across races and are very interested in constantly referring to that. But it is a multicultural social network of white African Americans and Latinos who all hate each other, meet each other, and actually live together and share the same spaces. And I use the participant observation methods that are well known in anthropology but are less known in biomedical research. It's qualitative research, and I try to translate it into the language that people who work primarily with quantitative measures and evidence, what's called evidence-based research, might understand it. So I tried to put it in somewhat square technical language, but I think it does translate well in a way that can be very comprehensible to people who primarily work with quantitative data, and I think it's very valuable to combine with quantitative methods and to conduct independently of quantitative methods, because you can get extraordinary access to information that's very hard to elicit through formal surveys, because as you've probably done yourself, most people lie on formal surveys. When your doctor asks you how much you drink, at most you say, oh, you know, a couple of drinks every now and then on the weekend, you know, at a dinner party, like that. Everyone drinks. Not everyone, but most people drink more than that. And doctors actually double the amount that they tell them. That's not a very good measure either. So with things like participant observation methods, you can actually see how much people drink, and you can actually test them out. You can ask them how much they drink, and then see how much they drink. And you follow them obsessively, and you're able to get to know them well. So participant observation actually does mean actually sleeping in these tents when you're as exhausted as Jeff and I were on this project. We didn't do that often, I must admit. Most of the time, we didn't hang out very intensively. And before beginning the talk, one of the points that I want you to take away and try to remember, because I think it's something that's incredibly useful in clinical work, is the anthropological concept of cultural relativism. It's a very straightforward concept, not hard to understand. But basically, cultural relativism means that you don't judge a culture. You just understand that the culture has different logics from your own. And that's what's going to help you understand what's going on in this interaction. And it's a hard thing to do, because our tendency, you know, the sort of universal human tendency is to be caught in your own culture and to think that your culture is actual common sense and should be everyone else's. When in fact, whatever culture that you're in is just one arbitrary culture, like so many others, that has completely different sets of logic for why, what's right and wrong. The thing that's actually, I think, most useful in this so-called cultural competence that we're all supposed to become culturally competent, and actually, when we get trained to become culturally competent, we often become even more incompetent. We get, you know, given laundry lists of how to behave, and that's obviously not kind of the laundry list that stereotypes people. So it's a very sort of complicated thing to try to teach and to try to develop in your life. And I think one of the easiest ways of doing it is just to become humble in front of culture and realize I'm ignorant in front of culture and I need to figure out what's going on and not think that I know what's going on. And that actually works incredibly well. People pick up on it right away in a positive way. So, I don't want to spend too long on these things. Then, I remember from, I was telling you this. You don't do that in social sciences, as you might remember. But I wanted to try to make this make sense to you. So basically, what I'm going to be looking at is to try to systematize why there's a certain set of patients that become so conflicted, primarily in hospital settings. This can be an outpatient clinical setting. I know Philadelphia has more outpatient clinical settings. Structure different because you don't have a general hospital. So I imagine many of the things I'll be describing would play themselves out in very settings. And also just this thing that you have to deal with when you see patients who self-abuse their bodies so brutally. And it just flummoxes you. It looks terrible. It's upsetting to see. And you patch them up and they go out and they leave it. And your attention becomes that. It's a normal thing to be able to accept because the lives of these people are at risk. And it's going to be very hard. You know, it's going to be very hard to figure out how to deal with them in a way that's productive for them. So the other thing is, you know, cultural relativism is fine to hear about on a theoretical level, mostly you nod your head in some sense, it's easy to grasp. It's much harder to systematize it and show how it works in practice, how you would use it analytically. So I hope that this will do some of that. So now, what I'm going to do is present a case study. I actually developed this for this clinical case study program that we had at UCSF, which was the interns would bring in their patients who were complicated by substance abuse problems, and then we would discuss them, and then they asked me to you know how doctors love to present, so you know patient here with such whatever one of the categories like that, and then. And then leave it out. So this was the idea. I wanted to present what someone looks like anthropologically in their fuller context rather than just the 30-second type of context of most, you know, clinic visits. So my very first field work, so I'm going to present these two guys. They're what's called running partners on the street, which means that they share all their resources and do all their hustling together. These guys primarily survives by panhandling, and he primarily survives by doing odd jobs and panhandling and petty theft. This is my fieldwork notes from 1996. Hank, an old-timer in his mid-50s, sleeps in a bright red pup tent, having just been thrown out of a project apartment in the neighborhood of Oak Hill, where he's been staying for the past year. He has a bad stab wound right under his right armpit from a pimp who he says is jealous of Hank's dealings with one of his prostitutes. Felix, another one of the homeless heroin injectors in our scene, dismisses Hank's bloody gash as being, quote, probably just an abscess that got cut out of him at the county hospital, so never believe a word that Hank says to you. And once we got used to Hank's blurred way of speaking and the way he shaked and bobbed uncontrollably when he got too high or too drunk, we grew actually quite close to him. It was fun hanging out with him because he was one of the few people that didn't hustle us constantly for money.
unlike most of the other students. And the fact of the matter is they hustle one another from them, so you can't take that personally. That's the nature of a heroin addict. They need to hustle everyone they come into contact with. And the problem is that people outside of their environment take that seriously as a moral transgression, when in fact it's simply the logic of being a heroin addict. They don't mean anything bad by stealing from them, what they have to do to comply in life. And it's, you know, it makes them quite unpleasant to deal with. But once you learn that logic, it makes it easier, you know, not to feel betrayed by them. Because they can actually really like you and still steal from you. And they can actually have a positive interaction with you and they'll still steal from you. And they can learn something from you in the clinical setting and still steal the telephone from the bedroom, you know, to get to leave. They still will have loved the services that they receive from you. It's a hard thing, actually, to wrap your head around. That is what happens. Matter of fact, it was kind of funny because when I present this at Grand Rounds at UCSF, the county hospital doctors and nurses were convinced that their patients hated them. Because half the time the interaction with the hospital is screaming and angry and all kinds of tense stuff going on. When in fact, when we talked to the guys on the street, they loved the interaction with the doctors. That was the best treatment they'd ever gotten in any institutional setting, and certainly better treatment than they got from their mother and father most of the time, from their brothers and sisters. So it was actually quite, there was a cultural miscommunication. When something's important to you on the street, you ask for it aggressively, and you raise your voice, and you hustle for it. And that looked very inappropriate. And when you like someone, care about someone, you try to dominate them in this way, often, when you're desperate. And so those are the kinds of things that turn you off in the clinical setting. But they actually think that it's a positive interaction that they're having. It's a strange thing. Okay, sorry, I got off the topic there. Hank sought a modicum of masculine dignity that is accorded to white, middle-aged, homeless heroin injectors who suffer from PTSD symptoms, post-traumatic disorder symptoms due to Vietnam. He interrupted his detailed gory stories about Vietnam with bouts of sobbing and shaking, and sometimes even ducking for cover when cars backfired. I'm embarrassed to say we tape-recorded several hours of his Vietnam firefight stories until we eventually got a response back from military service and found out that he had no record of military service. According to Hank's sister, who was also a homeless heroin injector, when Hank turned 18, he was classified 4F, unfit for military duty. Quote, that he didn't want to go into the army. He fixed it with both his hands right before going in for the interview. They looked like balloons. And this was at the end of the Vietnam War. Arguably, however, and this is the more important thing to remember, Hank did suffer from some of the PTSD. It wasn't from Vietnam. And I'll describe that. His sister explained to us, not in those terms. But she says, our father was French Polynesian from Papeete and worked in the shipyards, but he would get drinking and start getting crazy and bust up the house, beat up on my mother. Did Hank tell you about that? Hank would jump on our dad's back. He's like a little puppy dog up there on his back. Dad, Dad, leave mommy alone. And Hank tried to protect me too, and I got beat up by our older brother, but he'd get beaten up too. All of us got hooked on drugs. 35 years or so later, at age 50, Hank avoided contact with the county hospital emergency room by lancing his own abscesses. So it was a grotesque process to watch, and we interpreted it as self-mutilation, related to his traumatically violent childhood. And sorry about some of these pictures, except that clinical settings one doesn't have to apologize for these kind of pictures because you see them all the time and they're necessary for understanding what's going on the street in the real way. Otherwise, you think I'm making this stuff up. But when you see the pictures, it's right there. I'm understating everything rather than exaggerating anything. It was a grotesque process to watch, like I said, and he would talk about it in sort of disembodied terms, explaining to us what was going on.
And this is the worst of all the pictures. Well, no, there's two more worse ones coming up. But we actually thought that maybe he had some kind of... he's lancing an abscess, right? We thought maybe that he was, that he was in some way resolving his trauma with his father by cutting himself up. You often see that sort of psychiatrically with kids who've been abused by their parents. In the fact of the matter is, he was actually very successful. Now he's getting the, I guess it's called pus, out of the abscess. And the amazing thing is that he was basically successful with his lance. I mean, we saw him do this dozens and dozens of times, and most of the time it worked. There was a pilot program, an outpatient nurse who would visit the homeless encampments and actually provide expensive good bandages with good tape. And he put those bandages on, and then, to our horror, injects right into the side of the abscess immediately. So at that point, we were just convinced. This guy hates himself. He's a kook. He's totally traumatized. He needs psychiatric help, whatever. And I then showed this to my doctor friends, and they said, no, what are you talking about? The side of an abscess is a really smart place to inject. It's vascular. It doesn't hurt because it's dead. And this guy's other alternative... is to shoot him, if he wants a sudden rush of ecstatic pleasure, is to shoot himself in the jugular. Where would you rather shoot yourself, in the jugular or in an abscess that doesn't hurt? You get just about the same rush of pleasure as a direct deposit into a vein, and his veins are all completely scarred up. Here he is, quote-unquote, doing the favor of injecting a friend in the jugular. And the friend has to get it in the jugular because his veins are gone, and he wants that very recherché speedball effect, which is the thing that, actually in Philly more than San Francisco, that injectors absolutely adore, that combining of heroin with cocaine. And you can't inject that into the muscle. It has to go into a direct deposit, or else it just burns up the capillaries and you don't feel the effects of the cocaine. You'll feel the effects of the opiates, but you won't get the speedball effect. So if your priority in life is feeling the rush and pleasure of heroin, which is the priority of anyone who's been shooting heroin for a long term and who's organized their life around that, it's actually a very logical, a set of things to do, especially when, it would be a logical thing to do except that you, except for this phenomenon of abscesses. And so this is something that goes under the radar screen because basically only injectors get abscesses in large numbers. Bourgeois, normal, whatever type people, working class people, get abscesses very, very rarely. But injectors get them all the time. And they flood clinical services with abscesses. That's the primary reason that they come in for services. And as a matter of fact, at the county hospital, it was the single biggest admissions category. And at the time, unfortunately, there's no national standard of care for abscesses across the country. Yeah.
Like, is it just from continually injecting in the same spots, or...?
No, basically, it's, they're using dirty needles that have bacteria in them, and it's much, you have a much higher chance of getting it if you don't hit a vein directly. If you hit a vein directly, basically, your vascular system will just clean it out 99.9% of the time. But when you put it into your muscle... not even your muscle, your fatty tissue is where it's really, and most people, they call it muscling, but they're actually skin popping. And that's where you get the abscess, because then the bacteria festers in that spot and erupts. And so so abscesses get a lot worse as you age, because even though you're more experienced at finding, at using your veins, you're more frequently just going into the muscle area. And then you get an abscess by missing an injection, by slipping out of the vein, and it goes into into the capillaries and festers like that. So for example, this was his first and only abscess, and he didn't muscle, as you saw. He would spend up to an hour and a half looking for spots to inject in non-traditional locations. And what you're seeing is an iatrogenic procedure that was being done routinely on all 4,000 of the abscesses that were coming into the San Francisco General in the year 2001. There was nothing published in the literature about what to do about abscesses. And surgeons are pretty sociopathic when it comes to their procedures. They just do them and they think they're right, and they don't think that they need any evidence-based science to prove that their procedures are right. Their procedures are constantly changing when you look at them. And they did some incredible stuff with fake knee surgeries and stuff like that. And so what happened was, basically what was happening is patients were refusing to come into the county hospital for their abscesses because they were getting carved in this very deep carving. And they were being released without painkiller, because the doctors, most doctors, or many doctors, think that it's that it's not indicated, that you're not supposed to give painkillers to opiate users, that there's something medically wrong with that. I'm not sure why. If you have pain, you need pain like any other kind of person, and if you're an opiate user, you have a higher tolerance for pain, so you need more. If you're an active opiate user, you need more painkiller, not less. But this guy was released without any painkiller. With a cut like that, you can just imagine the kind of pain that represents.
So, is that what he got discharged?
Yeah. So he'd been discharged. Yeah,
from the abscess. Like
yeah. It was a carve. It was a carving rather than an incision and drain, which is the standard procedure that hopefully they do in Philadelphia, and that you saw Hank doing right with his manicure scissors, which leaves hardly any scar, which is which can be done almost without painkiller sometimes if the abscess is a certain kind, or with relatively little pain. And instead, they had a thing about necrotizing fasciitis, and so they were scared about missing diagnoses. I won't put my notes away, but they had a thing about for good reason. Necrotizing fasciitis just eats you up and can kill you in several hours, right, if it isn't diagnosed. It's very easy to diagnose it, however. You just watch the person for 45 minutes and you can watch it start to necrotize. But they were doing all 4,000 cases of abscesses in 2001 as if they had necrotizing fasciitis. There were only 12 documented cases of necrotizing fasciitis in the whole Bay Area during that same period. So it was just insane in terms of, until someone took a look at the statistics, presented it to the surgeons, and then they decided to do an evidence-based clinical trial of setting up an outpatient clinic to do a simple incision and drain, which already all the community-based clinics were doing on their own, and which the rest of the country was by and large doing on their own. And they found, lo and behold, to no one's surprise except the surgeons, that it worked much better. But this is the ultimate irony of everything. Then they published it in the most prestigious surgery journal to state that UCSF discovered the proper way to treat abscesses. It's just classic. A completely commonsensical process, but that wasn't documented in some sense. So you can't blame UCSF for having sort of done it wrong. They were worried, like good doctors, about necrotizing fasciitis. They could have talked to a nurse and said, could you watch this person to make sure they don't have necrotizing fasciitis, and then they could have not worried about it. But you actually have to take the person's temperature after 45 minutes, and then you can tell if they have necrotizing fasciitis. But instead of that, they were just letting them out. I shouldn't be so negative. They're really nice doctors, actually. And especially the surgeons that like to do abscesses, they're really devoted to an underserved population. But this is how horrible. I mean, it was completely out of control what they were doing. And what's amazing now, these doctors are friends of mine, when I talk to them about it, they do not objectively remember that they used to do this huge carving. I mean, this knowledge is, if we didn't have these pictures, they would say, no, you're just hostile to medicine and you're exaggerating. What is this weird exaggeration? And all we did was change it to an outpatient clinic. The inside scoop was they changed it to an outpatient clinic that was directed by a nurse who wouldn't allow any shouting in her clinic. And so the result of that was that all the doctors had to give everyone enough painkiller so that there were no screams of pain during any of the procedures. And that was the other thing that makes this now the most popular clinic for homeless heroin injectors in San Francisco. And they're coming in early now. The abscesses are getting treated as a simple, cheap outpatient clinic. Everyone's happy about it. They get enough painkiller when they're released.
you know, they don't have to immediately break into the first car that they see because they're in heroin withdrawal and terrible pain when they get released from the hospital. So it's actually been it's a positive story. Now, but I want to move on to a less easy type of problem. And this isn't a problem with a technical solution of just figuring out the proper procedure. But the fact of the matter is, in medicine, we're really completely subordinated to law enforcement in terms of competing for trying to do something about homeless drug users who have bad health. And the health, the effects of our clinics and so forth are much less, ultimately, than the effects of the war on drugs in shaping the dysfunctional behavior of many of the patients who come in with respect to us, and also the magnitude of the types of presentations that they bring in. And we often forget about this, but this has gotten much worse. I stopped this in 98. In 2003, it went up to above 1.8 million. And it's just, we're a pariah nation in the world in terms of the proportion of people that we arrest. And don't ask about the ethnicity of it, because it's bona fide apartheid in terms of the proportions of African Americans, whites, and Latinos who get arrested. It's really, it's profoundly embarrassing when you put up the statistics and compare us to, you know, any old normal country, you know, with even a relatively poor country has much, much fewer people arrested. Okay, so I'm going to switch now to so repeatedly the police ground up their blankets, sleeping bags, clothing, and tarps and garbage trucks as if they were useless trash. In this case, leaving Hank with one jacket and his sign painting materials. Actually, it wasn't Hank. This was Frank. With one jacket and his sign painting materials, because this particular person preferred to work painting signs for businesses rather than begging and stealing. Switching to Jeff's field notes. There's been yet another round of evictions, and Hank looks an absolute wreck. His eyes are so puffy that I ask him if he's been in a fight. Quote, "They wiped me out again. I went for a drink at the corner, and I returned, and there was the patrol car. I'm tempted to get my gun and shoot the next patrol car that I see." Hank starts shivering so hard, his nose running and teeth chattering, that he has to hug himself across his chest to steady himself. Max, one of the guys in the scene, recognizes Hank's particular patterns of opiate withdrawal symptoms and walks over and pats his arm, puts his arm around his shoulder, offering to give him a taste of some heroin he has just bought, but only on condition that Hank lends him a needle. All of Max's were confiscated in the last eviction. Hank reaches into his sock to pull out his only needle and hands it to Max, muttering apologetically, "That's all I got. The police had confiscated his earlier that day as well." After injecting, Max hands the needle back to Hank, who prepares a wet cotton shot with it from Max's leftovers. So, you know, what we see there from our biomedical perspective is a lot of, you were asking about abscesses, a lot of potential vectors for spreading abscesses, HIV and hepatitis C as well, especially, you know, using an old beer can as your cooker and squeezing and reworking an already used and dirty cotton filter that's been used and so forth. What's ironic about it is, from their perspective, it's completely different. From their perspective, by sharing like that, in that very, you know, objectively dangerous medical way, they are developing generous reputations vis-a-vis one another, and they're ensuring that they'll be able to find someone willing to kick them down a cotton, so to speak, to give them a taste of heroin whenever they're in a crisis, whenever the police have disrupted their hustling strategies and so forth. And so they won't find themselves dope sick, so to speak. So they actually think of themselves as protecting their health when they do these risky sharing practices. As a matter of fact, Hank was someone who was very generous, and he was always going to be offered by anyone a taste, because everyone knew that he would repay that in the future, and everyone owed him tastes from previous times when he'd helped them. So now I'm going to move on to Hank's running partner, Petey. On the morning following a major eviction, we arrived on the corner, these are fieldwork notes again, to find Petey crying. His running partner, Scotty, had died of an overdose in Petey's arms while they were sharing a sleeping bag to keep warm on the floor of a customer's rented room. Petey had been totally dependent on Scotty. Despite the fact that he had good veins that were easy to locate, Petey had never learned to inject himself. Every time he wanted to get high, he would have to beg Scotty to inject him, and Scotty enjoyed lording his power over Petey, especially when Petey was dope sick. Without Scotty, Petey became the lowest status member of our homeless community. Felix began calling him Baby Petey to his face, and sorry for the cursing, but it's necessary to sort of communicate the levels of interpersonal insult that take place, and the homophobia and so forth. That's just absolute common sense, tragically, on the street. And to his face, calling him Scotty's bitch. Hank came to Petey's rescue, offering to inject him whenever he needed. Soon they established a running partnership. It was 1998, and Northern California's dot-com and biotech booms were in full momentum. Mayor Brown reinstituted a law enforcement campaign of zero tolerance for quality of life infractions. Guess what we have in Philadelphia, the same one. Moving anxiously from temporary site to temporary site, the Edgewater homeless lost most of their blankets and sleeping bags, all of their tents and tarps, most of their needles, and all of their access to the Department of Public Health's mobile health van that used to visit their encampments regularly. This, and that's where, you know, we're just second fiddle to the reality of who has a public policy power in the United States. And actually, it isn't that simple. Every now and then, public health can make some difference. That one of the miraculous things that completely changed injector police relations was somehow the health department got a regulation passed at the municipal level to prohibit police from bringing in anyone with an abscess to the jail. They had to bring them first to the hospital if the person had an abscess. And the police just stopped all petty arrests, because what they would primarily do is just arrest someone for needle possession. That's the easiest thing to arrest someone on, and then charge them with needle selling. And so once you charge someone with needle selling, then they have to stay overnight till they see a judge. The judges just throw that out. They don't want to waste their time, their overcrowded dockets, with needle selling accusations from decrepit, you know, obvious addicts. And so, but what's happened is the injector has gone through withdrawal symptoms until they see the judge. So they've gone through the agony of throwing up all over themselves, knocking their head on the wall, and so forth, and then they get released. So you had this sort of harassment level type picking people up, and that just stopped because the poor police weren't going to waste their time. You've seen what an emergency room is like, waiting 6 hours to get seen in an emergency room with a smelly, bad smelling heroin injector who has an abscess on him. So all the injectors had to do at that point was tell the cops, I have an abscess on me, and they would let them go, unless it was something serious, right? And that completely changed the relationship for about a 6 month period till the police just started ignoring that directive. But it was an interesting thing to see, actually, that interface between the sort of left hand of public health and the right hand of law enforcement coming into conflict and actually, on some level, working together, because the police ended up bringing in a whole bunch of people that really needed to come into the hospital, who were completely out of control on the streets, that then prevented much more complicated medical presentations down the line. Okay. So this law enforcement offensive was difficult for everyone, but it was particularly hard on Hank and Petey, and their health deteriorated more rapidly than anyone else's. Hank and Petey, this is Jeff's field notes. Hank and Petey have been forced to move 6 times in the past 3 weeks. Hank has a cane in his left hand, and his leg quivers nonstop, unable to support his full weight. Doctors in the emergency room gave him the cane when he sought help, claiming he had fractured some discs in his lower back while lifting a grand piano on a moving job. Hank also has a terrible abscess on his rear, and that also might be what's making him limp. But his medical kit was confiscated by the police, and so he can't lance his abscess this time. And with his scissors, instead, he tears a piece of aluminum from a crushed soda can, pressing the jagged edge into the side of the abscess. Jeff implores Hank to stop and let him drive him to the hospital. Hank shrugs. I haven't showered in 30 days, Jeff. I'm too ashamed to see a doctor. The chronic pain in Hank's lower back made working for the moving company excruciatingly painful. The two running partners became primarily dependent on Petey's panhandling income. Hank's Vietnam references became increasingly vivid as his dependency on Petey increased. On one occasion, Jeff found Hank behind the corner store in the midst of a PTSD-style panic, gripping the chain link fence for sobbing so hard he had to grip the chain link fence for balance. He's convinced that Petey has been killed. Hank started experiencing mysterious seizures that he called mini strokes, and is taken to the hospital in an ambulance. Over the next year, he becomes what the emergency personnel at the county hospital call a frequent flyer. We attribute the seizures to delirium tremens from alcohol and suspect he might also be confabulating. But the hospital keeps admitting him because he has high fever each time he presents himself at the emergency room. The doctors can't pinpoint the biological cause of Hank's multiple distresses. Hank claims they have found a rare virus in his spine and that there are only two other known cases in the world, both men my age who were in Quang Tri province in Vietnam in 1970. The hospital would keep him for a week or two until his fever stabilized, and he was often under-medicated for his heroin withdrawal symptoms during these periods, making him your worst-case scenario, an angry, non-adherent patient constantly complaining or moaning in pain, not cooperative at all. Drawing for blood, for his multiple blood tests was an ordeal because he has so much scar tissue. He would beg the nurses to allow him to draw his own blood. On one of our visits, Hank explained to us, "I'm confused all the time. The doctor said there's a 50-50 chance that I might end up crippled. Something about a fungus in my bones that they say they want to operate on. Do you think I'll survive for even one day under the freeway as a cripple?" Meanwhile, Petey's health began to deteriorate as he stood panhandling in the winter rain, and this is Jeff's notes. "Petey's mouth hurts, and he opens it wide for me to take a look. The gums have rotted black, twisting the teeth on the bottom half of his mouth. The gums are bleeding, and he thinks that this might be why he has been throwing up for the past week. The next day, Petey lost all their blankets during yet another police eviction. He managed to sleep undetected in Hank's hospital room for several nights. Hank generously hooked up his IV antibiotic painkiller drip into Petey and ratcheted up the dial controlling the painkiller to keep Petey's withdrawal symptoms at bay. But meanwhile, in a last-ditch attempt to prevent surgery, the doctors switched Hank to a triple therapy regimen of IV antibiotics. His IV now had to be changed every 1.5 hours throughout the night, and the staff obviously caught Petey sleeping in the easy chair and evicted him into the rain despite his oncoming heroin withdrawal symptoms. 2 weeks later, Hank was back out on the street. The IV had indeed stabilized him, but due to cost-saving early release instructions, he was released and told to finish his treatment orally, quote, at home. The physician on our ethnographic team met with Hank while he was in the hospital, got informed consent from him, and reviewed his medical record, and then wrote a fieldwork note for us. Hank was hospitalized because of a focal seizure that he suffered. This type of seizure pushed the doctors to look for a localized lesion in his brain. The CAT scan revealed nothing, but when Hank started to, quote, spike fevers, a lumbar puncture was performed, revealing bacterial meningitis. Hank was put on ampicillin, vancomycin, and, I can't pronounce these, ceftriaxone. Later on, a discovery was made in reinterpreting the initial CT scan. There was evidence of subdural fluid collection. The doctors debated the need for surgery to drain the fluid collecting so rapidly around his brain, but they went for the triple therapy antibiotics instead. When I saw Hank in the hospital, he looked great. 2 weeks of food and rest appeared to wash away years of homelessness. He told me he felt great and that his only concern was imminent discharge. A few days later, the hospital released Hank back to the street. His official discharge papers reported psoasmiositis, and lumbar osteomyelitis and Clostridium bacteria COPD-L2-3 and L4-5 disc protrusion. And that's the most important thing there, because that makes him eligible for painkiller, you know, an objective problem with the discs in his lower back. But 3 days later, despite the fact that he had a prescription for both those three oral antibiotics, but unfortunately he also had a lot of morphine pills that they had given him, a prescription for that, the police confiscated all his pills and accused him of selling them. On one of our visits, we hear persistent honking from the back alley, and Hank runs out of the encampment. It's Eddie the mover. Hank is supposed to go to the hospital for another checkup for his chemotherapy on his spinal infection today, but instead he is going to work for Eddie. Meanwhile, P's gaunt face is covered with open sores. Tina, this was another woman in our scene, tells me that the police picked him up for panhandling yesterday and found three used syringes in his pocket. They've charged him with selling syringes, and he has a September 10 court date. Quote, his welfare check was cut off this month for missing his appointment. Petey gags and turns to spit a mouthful of blood in the gutter as Tina talks about him. 2 weeks later, Hank carried Petey, unconscious, into the emergency room, where he was immediately admitted to the ICU and stayed almost 6 weeks. Hank visited Petey every day, and sometimes companions from the scene came with him. Sobbing, Hank gently strokes Petey's hair. This might sound corny, but it really happened. Sonny is holding Hank's shoulders from behind, saying, "Look, Petey, Hank loves you, and he's holding you. And I love you and Hank, and I'm holding Hank. And Jeff is here, too, and he loves you. Lord, please protect our Petey." A pulmonary specialist enters with a resident and an intern to use Petey as a teaching case. The specialist removes the tube from Petey's throat and asks the intern to reintubate Petey. They are polite. Before rushing, and they actually did that a few times. Before rushing off to the next patient, they conscientiously provide us with a slew of technical medical information on Petey's condition that we do not understand. Petey lets out a rasping groan. With a Q-tip, the nurse gently swabs his lips, tongue, and the inside of his cheeks with Vaseline. He can't give Petey water because it might cause the lacerations on Petey's lips, mouth, and throat to bleed. In comprehensible language, the nurse explains the consequences of Petey's broken-down liver. His bloodstream now lacks the crucial proteins that stop bleeding because the liver produces the body's clotting factors. Furthermore, the blood and other bodily fluids that are not able to pass through Petey's liver are being pushed through the cells into his stomach and through the lining of his throat. This explains why his lips are oozing with blood and why his gums were bleeding all those weeks on the street. We learned that a guest visiting with Hank yesterday stole a tray of food from a patient. That must be Stretch. Last week he stole a telephone. Every morning he checks the hospital's roster for someone to visit, hoping to steal meds or anything else of value. The nurse gives Hank a bottle of baby oil, which Hank proceeds to rub into Petey's hands and his legs up to his thighs. An hour or so later, the nurse politely asks us to leave. They want to keep Petey unconscious so that he does not burst the clots in his throat and mouth. He shows us how Petey's heart rate becomes erratic when he gets agitated. He is safer sedated. Hank becomes anxious on the drive back to his encampment. He has decided to dig a hole like a squirrel and line it with cardboard to hide his belongings from the police. During the second month of Petey's hospitalization, Hank's cerebrospinal infection flared up again and sent him back to the hospital, through a 911 call. Hank was on the fourth floor again in the skilled nursing facility, and Petey was downstairs, finally out of the ICU, and to everyone's surprise, gaining strength and mobility. Soon, they both have mobile IVs and are visiting one another in their rooms. A nurse catches Hank adjusting the dials on Petey's analgesic IV drip. They struggle for control of the mechanism until Hank finally wrenches it out of her hands, almost knocking over his own IV, that is towing behind him on casters. The nurse runs out screaming for a doctor, and Hank shouts after her, "Go get him, I ain't scared. I've been attacked by the FBI and the CIA. Hank returns to his room, grabs his leather jacket, and stomps out of the hospital and returns to his encampment. On the way, he steals a bouquet of flowers from the flower shop to parlay for a bag of heroin from the dealer. 2 weeks later, that was actually the moment before going into the dealer. 2 weeks later, Hank is brought back to the hospital in an ambulance after collapsing with another seizure while panhandling at Petey's spot. This time, in addition to the IV antibiotics, the doctors included an extra heavy dose of opiate-based painkillers. Before leaving on one of his visits, Jeff checks at the nurse's station on the status of Hank's SSI disability application, but is told, the social workers do that, not us. And this cycle then continued for another year of early releases with instructions to take the rest of the course of antibiotics orally, and then about 6 weeks before it would flare up enough to have, for him to get picked up by an emergency technician. Meanwhile, Petey was released and was back to panhandling, drinking, and shooting heroin. He tells us, I don't know what to do. They threw me out of the hospital after 2 months in a coma. The doctor told the nurse that they needed my bed. Since he can walk around, he can leave. A few weeks later, so he cycles back and forth a couple more times. A few weeks later, a primary care resident coincidentally, and this is almost the end, presented Hank's case in a clinical conference that I was giving. That's the ones I was telling you about where the interns would be presenting the patients whose conditions were complicated by substance abuse. The resident was worried to the point of bursting into tears during her presentation because Hank had missed his last two outpatient appointments for triple antibiotic chemotherapy, because that was their attempted strategy was to make him come back physically since he wasn't doing it on his own. And she was sure that his spinal and brain fluid injection would relapse within the next few days or weeks. The last time she had seen him, the only thing he had been willing to talk to her about was his morphine prescription, for which he was asking for an early refill. Big surprise. Philippe tells the doctor about her hospital's new $50 prescription copay rule and explains that Hank does sell the pills in order to be able to afford the $50 copay. And what was interesting to me is that the doctors didn't know about the new $50 copay rule in their very own hospital. It wasn't something that they were being told about. And that was completely transforming the quality of life and emergency situation of all their indigent patients. Just a simple set of knowledge. And just by telling that at that intern thing that there's a $50 copay, even the attending didn't know that rule. And the attendant said, no problem. What you do is before releasing anyone, you give them their full set of prescriptions, and then they don't have to pay for it. And the system is perfectly happy with that. Luckily for Hank, the decay of his spine was visible on his x-rays, and the doctor has agreed after this clinical session to increase his prescription and fill it in-house to avoid the copay, on condition that he attend most of his outpatient chemotherapy appointments. And over the next 6 months, Hank had regular positive contact with the hospital, cleaned up his cerebrospinal infection, and better yet, it enabled the doctor to oversee the successful processing of both his Medi-Cal and Social Security disability paperwork that he now qualified for because of his spinal injury. And Hank then parlayed a portion of his $727 a month disability check into a rent payment that allowed him to become housed in a friend's garage. He gained weight, bathed regularly, always wore clean clothes, and began repairing cars. Meanwhile, Petey, who had the bad luck of becoming the nemesis of a police officer who kept spotting him standing by the drive-through exit at the Taco Bell while driving home, from his last shift, the cop just—I don't know what he had against Petey—but he'd be in his, home-dressed fancy shoes. He'd screech to a stop and go running after this decrepit, skinny, emaciated heroin addict, who would then just run into like the swampy bushes, and then the cop would go as far as there was too much mud that was going to dirty his pretty shoes. And he did that for several weeks until finally, he caught him. California had just passed Proposition 36, treatment not jail, a voters' initiative. And although Petey was detoxed cold turkey on the floor of his holding cell, during the week he spent in jail awaiting to get processed into treatment, coincidentally, Ben, another one of the guys in our scene, was also cycling through jail at that time and protected Petey from getting predated, raped and beaten up and so forth by his cellmates.
because Petey's only safeguard against rapacious inmates in the holding cell was, quote, keeping himself dirty, throwing up, and defecating all over himself. And, he wasn't even wearing shoes, Ben tells us. But Petey responded well to the tough love structure of his Veterans Administration-funded program, because he really was a vet and qualified for VA treatment. They have some great programs, at least in California, they had great drug treatment programs that were coupled with employment training. And he's actually now working as a custodian in a VA hospital, in the VA hospital in San Francisco. So I'll just stop with there, and we have plenty of, I think we have time if you're not too bored, to take questions.
How did you gain access to the community? And, I mean, do you just, are you still in touch with, obviously you are if you know where Petey is. Do you still see them? And I just didn't understand.
Actually, you know, part of the reason for taking a job at Penn was to get the heck out of San Francisco so I could get closure with this project. I do stay in touch with them. And that's the funny thing with ethnography is when it's in your hometown 6 blocks from your house, it just takes over your life. I couldn't go anywhere without seeing them. Because they were always out there. The amazing thing, though, is they knew where I lived. You know, I was right in the neighborhood, and they never abused that. Only on like 2 or 3 occasions did someone knock on my door in desperation, asking for money in a 12-year period, and only on a few occasions when it was real, true emergencies, sort of court-related type stuff, did they call me up and ask for favors like that and so forth. I was surprised, actually.
Yeah. But so how did you gain the access initially?
Oh, it's actually very easy. It's always a shock that it's very easy, but it just is. As soon as you're polite to someone, you're so exotic as a professor, as a nurse, as a doctor, as a public health worker, and you're so good, you have so much power that you can contact people with, that they want to have a good relationship with you. So as soon as you're not, being rude to them, bossing them around, or anything like that, they actually generally, there's a set of people who can't relate to you just because they're so pissed, they're so angry, they're so violent, you can't do it, you can't access super violent scenes. But there's a whole set of people that respond very well on the street to some positive interactions. And they would introduce me to their friends as my professor. This is my professor that I've been telling you about, and so forth. And then they started doubting our veracity when it took us 12 years to do the fieldwork and the book isn't coming out till now, 14 years later. So they started wondering if we were just flakes pretending. But I invited them to a few talks that I gave, they enjoyed being taken seriously. And like we do, they feel important. I mean, they feel they have something to teach the world. And they're ambivalently proud. I mean, that's with the term dope fiend. That's how it gets used on the street. It gets used by long-term heroin injectors. They have an ambivalent pride in who they are, that they're stone-cold dope fiends and they're, hope to die with my boots on dope fiends. They're not, that's basically sort of their identity in some sense. Although they also all express at one time or another a desire to go into treatment, usually around emergencies, usually when there's a police eviction or if someone gets killed or if someone dies of an overdose or if they're just, have a bad abscess or something like that. They'll say, I really want to go into treatment. And some of them did recover. It was actually quite remarkable to see that, like Petey and Tina also did. We didn't have any pictures of her.
I think there's a question over there.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
How did you change through those 12 years? Were you a different person at the beginning? Did you have some preconceived notions when you were going into the study? And how did you come out?
I don't know. I'm not that much in touch with, I'm one of these middle-aged, men who tries to not get in touch with their feelings, I guess. So I don't really know. I couldn't really tell you in any, that's just, the kind of cultural category that I got socialized into. So I'm too out of touch with myself to be able to know in any kind of a deep way. In the beginning it was very difficult doing the field work, it took me a long time,
to understand this, how to deal with their hustling. And I always kept feeling betrayed by the hustling. And I noticed that in the clinical setting, that's a problem that clinicians have to deal with. Because as soon as someone starts hustling you, you know, doing the drug-seeking behavior type thing, you immediately discount absolutely. What happens is the tendency is to get into an oppositional thing with the person and then just not believe a thing they ever tell you on anything. And it's much more of a gray area than that. And then the other thing, what I used to see is that clinicians would engage in who's more streetwise. And the fact of the matter is the person on the street is always more streetwise than you. You're just a pathetic ignorant when it comes to how brilliantly they know how to hustle people. And you just shouldn't go down that route of trying to say, I'm real tough and I know what to do and you can't fool me. You have to engage with it in a different way in some sense. You can acknowledge some of the stuff that you know, but when you get into, when you try to be as tough as they are, you just aren't. You shouldn't be, or you shouldn't be in medical practice.
Yeah. Broadly speaking, when these people come to us in the hospital, you know, we're looking at several different layers of problems. You know, you've got the biological stuff with the abscesses and infection, the gonadotropin. And then you've got patterns of social behavior that work very well for them out there and that they need to survive. What's the best thing that we can do for them?
Well, you know, I'd actually like to find that out from you because I don't know enough about Philly. In San Francisco, I saw a bunch of things that really did work incredibly well to decrease the sort of useless suffering in the lives of homeless drug users, and also to take pressure off of the institutions that were trying to deal with them. Because these are objectively difficult. It's not like they're noble victims. These are really complicated people that are often very unpleasant to deal with in an objective way. And I'm not romanticizing absolutely. I mean, you'd be an idiot to romanticize them. It's very frustrating for the people who are trying to, you know, do something in their interest and trying to take care of their bodies. What I need to know is more about Philadelphia. I mean, I've seen a few. One thing is you don't have the county hospital structure, right? So in San Francisco it was a little bit easier in that the only place I ever had to give talks was at the county hospital because basically 90% of all the homeless drug users were coming there for their stuff. And so there was a self-selection that the clinicians who liked or, you know, who felt a duty to deal with patients, you know, underserved patients, were at the county hospital. So it was very easy to discuss it in settings like this, and people were very, very familiar with the patients. But here, the patients are dispersed in dozens of different emergency rooms, in dozens of different outpatient clinics. So there isn't that special, you know, people don't develop that specialized expertise of learning to recognize the difference between a cocaine injector, a heroin, because all those things are incredibly useful to know. And what I see in Philadelphia, I've been hanging out in North Philly and Kensington, and people actually look in worse shape to me physically in Philadelphia. And it came as a bit of a surprise. And I'm seeing more people injecting cocaine with their heroin than I saw in San Francisco. And cocaine is just the worst thing to inject. First of all, it's an incredible HIV vector because you can inject up to, you know, dozens of times because you go crazy trying to get that rush, and you can do it every 5 minutes if you've got enough money, and you become a bloody mess and you don't remember it the next day or even a few hours later. There's powder cocaine on the streets of Philadelphia. You didn't have powder cocaine on the streets of San Francisco. You just had crack and heroin, and of course marijuana. And here, there's, you know, obviously a lot of crack, but also a lot of very good quality heroin and a lot of very good quality cheap cocaine. And so I think your patients must be in worse shape in some sense than the ones that I actually saw. I don't know what kinds of programs you have already, but there are a few that worked really well. The one that was like magic was this high utilizer program, and it was just done as a cost-saving measure. I mean, I gave a bunch of talks like this, and there were a bunch of doctors who would brainstorm and so forth about it. And the trick was that they would put a social worker, not a doctor, basically they would run a statistic, and they found that you know, 20% or whatever it is, 15% of the patients were using 80% of the resources of the hospital. And they were patients like Hank and Petey. And or else they were just very old patients who were very sick and there's nothing you could do about it. But a lot of them were relatively young, you know, middle-aged patients like Hank and Petey. And so then when that person would come in, it would, you know, a beep would come up on the computer screen and they would get channeled to get treated by a team. And the trick was they put a social worker at the head of the team to coordinate it. So it became a clinical case management team. And that completely reduced that frequent flyer cycling thing. And they just allocated more resources. And they, you know, got more, you know, more nurses and doctors involved with that person. And that just brings in more sets of resources. I mean, the kinds of things that I saw so that was really good. I don't know here if you have that kind of a proportion in your clinics. But there might be. I mean, it might be that 5% or, you know, of the patients are recurrent users that just with not that much more expenses, but a coordinated clinical type of case management thing completely get transformed. And also, you get a self-selected group of clinicians who want to work on these teams. And that makes a big difference. You shouldn't force people who can't stand addicts to work with addicts. I mean, they shouldn't be allowed to work with addicts, as far as I'm concerned, because addicts are difficult people to work with, and they're very vulnerable. And so if you hate them and think that they should be punished, you know, you torture them. And I used to see some clinicians doing that, especially some of that gouging was related to just wanting to punish in some sense. I'm going to teach you a lesson now. Don't you want to go into treatment now? That was an amazing thing. One of the doctors told that to one of our guys. He'd been on a waiting list for 6 weeks to a treatment program. And actually it was the admitting nurse told him, don't you wish that you were in treatment now? And he had been trying to get into treatment. But there isn't treatment on demand. That's just a lie. It just doesn't exist, period. no matter what the politicians say or and so forth. You have to prove readiness.
Understand about this disease transmission or have interest in if they have access to clean needles, will they?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and they've changed their behavior. The stuff that you saw, the behavior that you saw, some of the evidence indicates that in medicine we have a somewhat hypersanitary understanding of how HIV gets transmitted. You know, you can't prove this completely with the evidence, you know, with the statistics, but I think the weight of the evidence is there. You're not getting it from indirect sharing is what I'm seeing. You're getting it from direct needle sharing. And with hepatitis C, it might be different, because hepatitis C is so much more infectious than HIV. But basically what they're not doing anymore, or they're rarely directly sharing needles unless there's been a sudden police sweep or something like that that forces them to. But that's one thing that they've learned. I mean, they've learned better than medicine in some sense. And you see very, very low rates of HIV now. I mean, the rates have gone down because there has been a profound shift in the behavior of street injectors. Believe it or not, they actually are injecting much more, in a much more sanitary way now than they were 15 years ago. And basically what they've gotten rid of is the direct needle sharing. The other thing, and I have a paper on this in the International Journal of Drug Policy, is that, and this is something that has been proved by the laboratory technicians, just rinsing with water is all you need for cleaning out HIV from a syringe. It's hard to believe, but that they've done it in the laboratories. There's not any ambiguity about it. Yet for some reason, we have all kinds of fantasies about bleach and rinsing with bleach and then water. But water is all you need for getting rid of HIV from a used needle. You shouldn't do it anyhow, obviously, because there's bacteria and other things. But basically, you know, if my son was out there on the street, I would say rinse with water at least. Because you know that someone does find themselves in that situation where they're dope sick and they're not going to, you know, pay or wait or search out for a clean needle. That's, you know, it's not universal, but it's, you know, most people on the street have at one point or another done one of those super risky types of behaviors. And most people do it regularly, you know, but they have changed their behavior. And so they're very educated in terms of, you know, they go on those NIH funded projects. As soon as there's any project, they volunteer for it, and then they go through mandatory counseling and all that kind of stuff. So they've actually heard the HIV raps a lot, and they're they know the details of it.
Yeah. When you say direct versus indirect sharing, indirect, do you mean that they wash it off first?
No, the indirect sharing would be, for example, if you just share the cooker. So, in other words, if you put the heroin, if you pool your heroin, you buy it, let's say you and I buy a bag of heroin together, and we each put in half the price, and then we only have one cooker, we're only going to use one cooker, because it's sort of wasteful to do it any other way, and it's more accurate to dissolve it in liquid and then measure out the liquid units, and that, then you get the most accurate half and half split between however money, if we each put in $5 on it. So they're often doing that form of indirect sharing. So they've used the same, cotton, the same water, and they've drawn water from the same container, each with a different needle maybe. So the water